Good morning. Let's begin with prayer. Father, we thank you again for calling us out of the world and into the family of God. Pray you'll bless this Lord's Day of worship and rest and bless our time together now as we consider your word and the resurrection of the Lord. For we ask in Jesus' name, amen. Well, this is week two of a planned four-week Sunday school class on the evidence for the resurrection, and I want to recap what we talked about last week, that Christianity is a resurrection faith, which makes it very unique in that way, and a resurrection faith that's rooted in history. We said that our main approach in this is going to be to look at the scriptures as historical documents so that the arguments that are being presented could be presented to a doubter, someone wrestling with their faith, or a complete skeptic. And we'll talk more about that approach again in a few minutes. But I do hope it'll be encouraging and a confidence builder as we look through this. My primary sources are The Resurrection of the Son of God by N.T. Wright, which is a nearly 800-page academic book on the resurrection. Richard Baucom's Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, another very large academic-type study. And then Gary Habermas, who has The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, where he consolidates this stuff in a very easy format for Christians to use in sharing their faith in Christ and the resurrection. One of the criticisms of the gospel record is that they were written down many decades after the event and not by eyewitnesses, and hence legends and other things came into the story of Jesus. And we said last time that there's actually a very short time frame, this idea of decades upon decades of the story evolving, don't seem to be accurate when we look at the length of time that it took from the resurrection of Christ. We said that some of the early creeds revealed, and we'll go back to those again today, 1 Corinthians 15 is an important one, that a short statement of faith that many scholars, even unbelieving ones, think go back to the very earliest days after the resurrection, about Christ rising from the dead and appearing to Peter and others. Paul's going to be critical, and we're going to deal with Paul in more detail next week. But Paul's writings, many critics accept Paul as a historical figure. What he said, they believe he thought to be true, and that many of his letters are accepted. And he's writing within 20 or 30 years of the resurrection, not a very long time period at all. We don't know exactly when the Synoptic Gospels were written, but probably within 30 or 40 years of the resurrection, and drawing on eyewitness account and probably some shorter writings of the sayings of Christ and so on. Taking my cue from Richard Baucom and others, that these eyewitness accounts were passed down orally, and that the eyewitnesses served as guarantors of the accuracy of the description that is portrayed. We get that idea early on. Paul, when he's describing his conversion and then going and meeting with the apostles, they were no doubt conferring with one another. What was your resurrection experience? What are you teaching about the Lord Jesus Christ? And we know that there was a very formal council. This happened, by the way, within 3 years of Paul's conversion, so probably about 5 years after the resurrection that Paul's meeting with the apostles. He meets again with the apostles about 15 years later at what we know as the Jerusalem Council, where Paul is laying out the gospel he's preaching to the disciples, the apostles in Jerusalem, and understanding that they're all on the same page. And we'll deal more with Paul next time. We also talked about the fact that the Jewish concept of the Messiah and resurrection were not at all the Messiah and the resurrection that was proclaimed after Jesus' resurrection. They had a whole new view of the Messiah. And what was it that changed this view? Not that he would be a conquering hero to liberate Israel, but that he would be a suffering servant who died, and that there's actually going to be two comings of Christ, and so on. And their concept of resurrection, and N.T. Wright goes into detail about this, was really twofold, that the nation of Israel would be restored, and that someday in the future, there will be a great day of the Lord where his righteous ones will be raised up. It wasn't that one person would be raised as the case of Jesus. This kind of exploded their concept of that. And critics have to answer the question, how did these change? Why would there be this radical change in the early Christians' understanding of the Messiah and resurrection? There certainly was no expectation of a Messiah that was going to be put to death and to rise again. We also talked about the fact that we have four different accounts of the resurrection, and then Paul's description of his encounter with Christ. And these four different accounts strike at the heart at the idea that this stuff was made up many decades later, and we'll go into that. We quickly mentioned some surprises in the resurrection accounts that we wouldn't expect if they were made up many decades later. And these were the lack of biblical references to the Old Testament regarding different aspects of Christ's resurrection, the absence of any personal hope that Jesus' resurrection means we will be resurrected too. These stories don't include anything like that. They don't talk about Jesus as a shining figure, as you would expect they would if they were hearkening back to Daniel 12. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. The prominence of women in the accounts, women not being recognized as valid witnesses, both to the Romans and to the Jews. If they're making this up a long time later, why would they make women so critical to the story of the resurrection account? And then the fact that each of these four Gospels talk about the risen Christ as the same but different. They recognized him. He had the wounds of the crucifixion, but he was different. There was an element of transformation in his body. And last time, we dealt with these facts that are widely accepted by critics of the Gospels and the New Testaments that you see listed on your sheet. We talked about the first one last time, that Jesus died by crucifixion at the hands of the Romans. And today we'll pick up on the second. And you see those six facts there. And through the course of, Lord willing, these next 3 weeks, we'll go over those. But before we go on to fact number two, I wanted to say a bit more about eyewitnesses and memory. Because in the last 30 or 40 years, this has been an attack of critics. And Richard Baucom, in his book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, talks about this, that critics of the Gospels argue that memory is extremely faulty and very unreliable. And there have been studies of eyewitness testimony in court and how unreliable it is and so forth. And of course, we all know that we can get things confused our memories get mixed up at times, and so on. If you read Bart Ehrman, he's one of the most widely known critics. He's on all sorts of podcasts, and you can find him on YouTube. He was a former believer who's a New Testament scholar who's now probably the most outspoken unbeliever trying to debunk the Gospels. But if you listen to Bart Ehrman, you would wonder how we would know anything about anything that happened in the past. He just says memory is completely worthless. But there have been studies, and Bachman talks about this, about the way that our memory operates and the kinds of things that make us remember more significantly. And so psychologists have done a variety of studies, and this isn't going to surprise you, but they say that there's several factors that are important in being able to retain a memory. The first is it a unique or unusual event? The second, is it a consequential event, that this event is going to mean something in your life, getting married or something like that? Is the person emotionally involved? And then is there frequent rehearsal? Do you talk about it and remind yourself? Well, as you can see, of those four things, obviously the gospel writers, if they did indeed see the resurrected Christ, they would have seen it as unique, as consequential, as involving them personally, and as something that they would rehearse, right? They didn't leave the grave saying, wow, that's strange, Jesus is alive, and then never shared that with anybody. Psychologists also know that when we share a memory, we begin to imprint that memory. And over time, we share the memory in the same way. I'm sure if you stop and think about it, if somebody asks you how you met your future spouse or some particular thing that happened to you, there's a way over time that you tell that story. And that they believe the same thing is happening there. All the studies they do about eyewitnesses and debunking memory because of eyewitnesses, if you think about it, in court, what are these eyewitnesses being asked to do? What time did you see this person? What was this person wearing? That sort of thing. What exactly did he or she say? Those are the sorts of things that we don't remember in detail as much as the gist of something. What happened? You know, all the people in the bank know the bank was robbed. Do they all remember exactly how many robbers were in the bank, what their faces look like, and so on? No. Also, these sorts of memories are bystander memories, right? You're there and you see a traffic accident. You're there and a crime is committed. It's not affecting your life as a participant in the way that the gospel accounts are going to record. Okay, so the gist, but also key essential elements come out as well, specifics. And the gospels are full of that, right? They don't tell the story of one day there was a whole bunch of people and Jesus fed them some food. It was there were 5,000 men and they used 2 fish, 5 loaves, and so on. Okay. So frequent rehearsal is obviously going to be what happened to these eyewitnesses to the resurrection. So when you hear criticisms that, you know, memory is kind of worthless, we're not going to remember things, it's actually not true. Another criticism is that, well, oral societies, non-literate people, when they're passing down stories, Ehrman makes this point in one of his lectures, they're expected to change the story. That the audience wants to hear something new, a new twist on the story. And therefore, if people are telling the story of the resurrection, they're adding a new twist over the decades. Of course, you're going to get these fanciful tales that we read about in the Gospels, they argue. Bachman went back and looked at these studies, and he said, yes, it is true that certain kinds of stories shared in oral traditions are expected to embellish, but these are stories of entertainment. He said they're not stories of religious or clan history. They're not supposed to mess with those. And in many of those cultures, there's somebody designated as the keeper of the facts, somebody who will make sure that these core things are kept true. Bachman makes the point that the apostles served as these primary keepers of the facts, but there were other eyewitnesses as well. And again, this isn't a super long time frame that we're talking about. It's relatively short. And I thought, okay, think about the start of Covenant High School. Now, some of you are too young to think about that, but there's people in this room that lived through that time period. Teachers, parents of students, students themselves who were around this is the 33rd year of Covenant High School. If we asked them, tell us a little something about Covenant High School, do you think we could get a general idea of the first year or two of CHS? It's very reasonable, right? There's going to probably be general agreement. We only had three classrooms to start off with. So general agreement on the layout of the classrooms, the excellent school leadership, and so forth. But they're going to come up with different number of names, right? They might remember a few teachers that were there. Someone might remember a whole bunch of teachers. They might remember a handful of students that were there that first year. Someone might know a lot more. 33 years ago, that's almost the exact time frame that we're talking about in the writing of the Gospels, if they weren't written earlier. So it's relatively short period. But imagine if that first year, the fall of 1992, George H.W. Bush came to Tacoma on a campaign, right? He's campaigning for the presidency that year. And let's say he comes to Tacoma with his old boss, Ronald Reagan. And they're raising money, and they're campaigning, and they're in favor of school choice. And they hear about a startup school, a private school in Tacoma, and they come and they visit Covenant High School for a day. They speak in the classes. They eat lunch in the lunchroom, which were the classrooms, or the hallway in those days. Do you think that these people you interviewed would recall meeting President Bush and President Reagan? I think they most certainly would, right? Hi, Isaac. Now, I'm not a name dropper. I think those of you who know me know that. But I met Alan Hale Jr., the skipper from Gilligan's Island. In 1977, okay? I could tell you where I was and what he did and even generally what he was wearing, okay? And even though this encounter was a group that I was with, encountered the skipper, talked with him for a few minutes, that's imprinted on my memory. And granted, the skipper isn't that important of a figure. On that same trip, I also had a short conversation with David Bowie, the rock singer. I was in a downtown Tokyo clothing store, and I was at a table looking at some kimonos, and I looked up, and David Bowie was on the other side looking at kimonos. Our eyes met, and I said, hi, and he said, hi back, okay? Interestingly, I had the exact same conversation with Dennis Quaid in 2016 when we were deplaning in Iceland and we crossed paths. Funny how these things happen. But You remember that. And of course, an actor or a TV personality or a singer is nothing compared to meeting the risen Christ. Memories are not going to suddenly say Jesus rose from the dead when he didn't over time. Okay, so getting back to our six widely held facts that most scholars will agree to. Last time we talked about Christ's crucifixion. So from Easter Sunday onward, no one was able to find Jesus' dead body or the empty tomb, right? Each gospel reports an empty tomb. Paul in the Creed says that Jesus was crucified, buried, and rose again and appeared to Peter and to the 12 and to 500 people at one time, and so on. Certainly, we know that the Roman and the Jewish leadership never produced the corpse of Jesus. So there are some alternate explanations for that, right? As you'll see, one written about in the scripture is that the story spread that the disciples came and stole the body of Jesus, right? And Justin Martyr tells us that in 150, the Jewish authorities were still using that as an explanation for why Jesus' body wasn't found. There's lots of reasons why that's highly unlikely, right? The picture we get of the disciples is not bold and courageous guys who are going to organize a nighttime raid on Jesus' tomb. We'll talk about other problems with that. Another one is that the women and the disciples went to the wrong tomb. I mean, they were grieving. All this stuff happened. Jesus is buried. It's understandable. They went to the wrong tomb, saw that Jesus wasn't there, and said he must have rose from the dead. Okay. I think you could think of problems with this story, right? If they went to the wrong tomb, why didn't the Jewish leadership and the Romans go to the right tomb, say, here's this dead body, and put an end to this? Some people say, well, now, wait a second. This stuff didn't really start moving for several weeks after Jesus' resurrection. By then, the body would be probably somewhat degraded, and so it wouldn't do any good to try to bring out his body because it would have begun to decay and so forth. Another thing that is said is that that this is a legend that arose over time, very likely tied to other ideas of rising gods in the Greco-Roman world. And N.T. Wright, in an interview that I read, he said that originally the resurrection of the Son of God, he planned to be 200 or 300 pages. It ended up being 750 pages. And he said the reason is because he began to look into these stories of, oh yeah, gods died and rised all the time. People died and rose again all the time. And so he began to examine these examples of this, and N.T. Wright said these weren't at all as these critics were showing. They weren't at all written in the style of something that actually happened. They also never really were a person rising bodily in the same way that Jesus did. That N.T. Wright said as he was studying this, he got angry that there was so much poor cherry-picking of these so-called genres, death genres. These are known as Scheintot motif novels, apparent death novels. Anyway, N.T. Wright points out that almost all of these were written 100 years after the resurrection of Jesus. And the one that's quoted the most was written at least 100, probably 150 years after the resurrection of Jesus, when the story of Christ's resurrection would have been widely heard as Christianity spread. But N.T. Wright finishes this, "We should be quite clear. In these stories, no actual resurrection ever occurs, and nobody supposes that it can." We'll come back to this idea again. But the stories don't read like legends, right? They read like eyewitness accounts. Let me read to you just briefly from the Gospel of Peter, a non-canonical story they think was written probably 100 years after the original Gospels. And this is a gist of what the Gospel of Peter says as someone thinking back on this resurrection story and making it legendary. It said, "Jesus had died and was buried in a cave-like structure. Soldiers guarded the tomb. A loud voice rang out. The skies opened up and two men descend in blinding brightness to the sepulcher. The stone rolls away. The soldiers all see this. While telling others, they see not two, but three men coming out of the grave. The two from the sky are supporting the third one, Jesus, and a cross is following them. The two are so tall that their heads reach all the way to the sky. The head of the one they are supporting," I'm not sure why they have to support Jesus, "but the one that they're supporting is higher yet, and his head reaches beyond the sky. They hear a voice from the sky, 'You have spoken to those who sleep,' and the cross," not the two men or Jesus, "the cross answers, 'Yes.'" And then it goes on to describe Jesus appearing to Pilate and the high priest, all the stuff that someone would like to have heard about. It's clearly not written in the vein of an eyewitness account. This is what C.S. Lewis says about this idea that the gospel accounts are legendary. And remember, C.S. Lewis was a literary scholar of myths, legends, and so on. Lewis wrote, "Some regard the accounts of Jesus as being legend. Now, as a literary historian, I'm perfectly convinced that whatever else the Gospels are, they're not legends. I have read a great deal of legend, and I'm quite clear that they are not the same sort of thing. There is nothing, even in modern literature, until about 100 years ago, so about the middle of the 1800s, when the realistic novel came into existence. The author put it simply because this is the way the author saw it." And then in another place, Lewis wrote, "I've been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they're like. I know none of them are like the Gospels. Of this text, there are only two possible views. Either this is actual reportage, or else some unknown writer, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of the modern novelistic realistic narrative. The reader who doesn't see this has simply not learned how to read." So C.S. Lewis makes it clear that this isn't legendary literature. This is clearly someone reporting what they believe they saw, if you don't want to accept what they saw. Another criticism about the empty tomb is that Jesus was likely dumped in a mass grave. The Romans are not going to take a crucified criminal and allow him a proper burial. So obviously, his body, the two thieves on the cross, were chucked in a mass grave, and vultures and wild dogs or whatever made short shrift of these bodies. And that's why the Romans weren't able to produce the body. Well, there's no evidence that that's what happened, right? That's complete speculation. At least the gospel has four accounts of what they say happened. But also, people have studied Roman law, and they found that in Roman law, it permits an executed criminal to be taken and given a proper burial by the family or friends. It fits with this that if Joseph of Arimathea went to Pilate, here's a Jewish leader, yeah, go ahead, take the body, do whatever you want to do. Another idea is that no way would this happen to a crucified individual, but some of you may know that 30 or 40 years ago, they found an ossuary of a crucified man where the nail was still in his heel in a little north of Jerusalem. And I saw the replica of it. They don't display the actual one, but a replica of what it looked like in the Israel Museum. Maybe some of you others who've been there have seen that as well. Okay. Of course, an empty tomb by itself is not going to explain the resurrection, but it's an interesting piece of the puzzle. It certainly didn't solve it for Mary Magdalene. She found an empty tomb and she thought somebody had moved the body to another place. And when Peter ran to the tomb, he didn't conclude that Jesus was resurrected by seeing an empty tomb. But it's also a good idea to tell us that Mary and Peter were not expecting a resurrection. Okay, so the disciples believed, moving on to fact three, Jesus' disciples believed that they had seen him bodily resurrected. N.T. Wright will frequently, in his book, come back to what do modern critics, what does the main body of modern critics say happened with these gospel stories? And basically, the rundown is like this, that the disciples, maybe Peter, maybe another one, had a vision of Christ exalted in heaven. And so it began as Jesus in heaven as an exalted person, loved by God. And Mark's account of the resurrection is believed to be the first one, and it's really concise, and it doesn't say anything about Jesus appearing to any disciples. And they argue that over the decades, the appearance stories are added for different reasons, to elevate who Christ was, and so on. Then, to fight the idea that Jesus wasn't really a human being, the Gnostic idea that he sort of a hologram, he really wasn't a person the way we are people, to fight that, these later Gospels said, well, we've got to get Jesus really physical, so let's have him tell Thomas, hey, touch me. Or we'll have him have a breakfast of fish on the beach with the disciples. That'll show that he had a physical body. But then if people get too caught up in the physical body, a little while later they had to add the ascension to heaven story so that you have Jesus physically raised, but we got to get back to him being exalted in heaven. And so they made up the ascension story. That's the gist of the how these legends supposedly developed. And then they talk about rivalries in the apostles. I remember learning this in a class that I took in college on biblical literature, that there were these fights for supremacy between Peter and John and Peter and James and so on. And so the Gospels inserted nasty stuff about these guys to try to bring them down a peg or two. We'll talk more about some of those later on. However, the bottom line is there's virtual consensus among scholarship today who study these things, both as historians and New Testament scholars. They accept the fact that the disciples believed that they had seen Jesus risen from the dead. They say, yeah, you know, just based on what we're observing, yeah, they thought that happened. And of course, the gospel accounts say it. Paul says it. The early church creeds that we talked about embedded in different places like 1 Corinthians 15 say it. And so did the early Christian writers. Something that's always brought up by Christians is the apostles were persecuted. They were tortured. They were executed for their faith. If they stole the body or if they made this stuff up over the decades, they wouldn't have done that, right? That's always been a strong argument for Christianity. These people were radically changed in proclaiming Jesus as raised from the dead and suffering for it. I was listening to one critic recently, a podcast, and he said, we have no idea that the apostles suffered for their faith. The Gospels, they don't tell us that Peter was crucified. They don't tell us that what happened to these different people. We know Stephen got stoned, but we really don't know that they suffered persecution and so forth, because the Bible doesn't say that they did, although Paul describes some pretty nasty stuff that happened to him, right, during his ministry. However, there are some extra-biblical references that you see there, like Josephus, the Jewish/Roman historian. He reports about James, the brother of Jesus, being executed. Clement, the bishop of Rome, reports on the martyrdom of Peter and Paul. Polycarp does as well. And these are all within less than 100 years of these things happening, and some a lot sooner than that. The Roman historian Tacitus describes Nero blaming the burning of Rome on Christians and the terrible persecution that they suffered afterwards. This would not be doubted in any other ancient historical debate that the apostles actually suffered for their faith. But I bring it up because you will hear that. So what are some of the other things that critics argue happened? And we shouldn't be afraid of listening to critics. I know for some Christians, they feel, I don't really want to hear what these opponents of Christianity have to say. I have my faith, and that's fine, but you'll be surprised how unimpressive the critics actually are. I remember years ago stumbling onto a cassette tape. You younger people can ask older people, what's that? But the cassette tape was by a New York rabbi who gave a lecture on why Jesus could not have been the Messiah or the Son of God as described by Christians. And on the label of this cassette, I still don't remember how it came into my possession, but anyway, on the label of the cassette it says, if you're a Christian, do not listen to this. And when I took the tape, and I mean, I was nervous, I have to admit. I was a fairly young Christian. I pushed the button nervously, and this rabbi begins by saying, this is a message for Jews. There are Jews being sucked into Christianity, and it needs to stop. And this is a message for Jews. I plead with you, if you are a Christian, stop the tape. I don't have any interest in undermining your faith. And I nervously listened on. This is what his argument was. Christians say that Jesus was sinless. He treated his mom like dirt. She asked him to turn water into wine, and he said, woman. He didn't even call him his mother. He just dismissed his mother. And then another time in the Gospels, his mother, very concerned about him, comes with his brothers to meet with Jesus, and they tell Jesus, who's teaching inside this house, hey, your mom and your brothers are outside. Does he rush to greet his mother? No, he sits back, makes them cool their heels outside, and says, who's my mother and my brother? You're my mother and my brother and my sister. How could anyone treat their mother like that? That was one of his main ones. Another one was his driving out the money changers in the temple. He had no authority to do this. He did not submit to authority. He could have gone through the regular channels. Instead, he took matters into his own hands. And then he quibbled with something about his ancestry or something. And I thought, that's it? That's all this guy's got? And I felt the same way as I've been doing this class. Okay. So some of these other theories, the fraud theory, right, that Jesus or the disciples stole the body and they organized a conspiracy to say, let's tell everybody that he rose from the dead and we'll keep this thing going. But we've talked about the fact that that's highly unlikely that someone is going to die for something that they know is a lie. Because people will say, well, wait a second, people die for their faith all the time. What about the 9/11 terrorists? They killed themselves with those airplanes because they firmly believed in their religion. It's the same thing with the apostles. Well, it's not the same thing, right? Yes, there are people that will die for their faith, but they do it thinking that it's true, right? These guys, they didn't know, hey, Islam's a fraud. All the stuff we are supposedly standing for is a bunch of garbage, but let's fly these planes into these buildings anyway. No, they firmly believed it. But if the disciples did not actually see a raised Christ, they're not going to be tortured, imprisoned, and executed for that belief. Charles Colson makes the point that if this was a conspiracy with the 11 disciples, it would have broken down. He said, I know something about conspiracies. He, of course, was involved in the Watergate cover-up. He said, there is no way that you could get 11 people holding on to a lie that would lead to imprisonment, torture, and so on. He said, our conspiracy broke down in 10 days when John Dean squealed to the authorities about what happened. Colson said that as an impossibility. That goes totally against human nature and what we know about conspiracies. So today, there's very few scholars that argue that this was a fraud. It doesn't hold up at all. You've no doubt heard about the swoon theory that Jesus didn't really die on the cross. He recovered and so on. This has been debunked because even if Jesus wasn't nailed to the cross, the scourging would have taken him months to recover from. He wouldn't be convincing anybody that he was something special by limping around and appearing. So hardly anybody takes that idea seriously anymore either. The main one that's talked about is legend, that these things developed over time and got exaggerated to the point, so forth. We've talked about legend when we talked about the empty tomb. And of course, there are problems with that because we have this early creed in 1 Corinthians that was Paul is referencing within 20 years of the resurrection, something that he got from the apostles or other believers earlier than that. As we mentioned last week, most people think that short creed in Corinthians 15:3-8 1 Corinthians 15, 3-8, comes from months after the cross. So they're talking about Jesus being resurrected. There's no evidence that there was an embellishment of these stories over time. And Jews, when talking about religious matters, didn't typically embellish very much. There was a strong sense of care for the word as it is described. We talked about these so-called novels, these Greek novels. Another thing that's brought up, I just listened to yesterday, a guy talking about Christians say the resurrection is the center of their religion. Every religion has a resurrection. There's resurrection in all these different religions, whether it's Hindu or Buddhist or Islam. There are these stories that develop, and even ancient Egypt. Well, N.T. Wright spends several chapters going through and examining these legends, and he said they're not anything like the kind of resurrection that is being talked about in the Gospels. He said that some people refer to the Greek mythical figure Adonis and his so-called rising from the dead story as an example of where the Christians got theirs. The trouble is, most people date that at 150, so it's long after the resurrection. He says this, there are no accounts of a resurrection of Attis. This guy I listened to yesterday talked about Attis, the god of vegetation who's responsible for the death and rebirth of plant life until the early 3rd century. Wright acknowledges that in Egyptian belief, there in the cult of Osiris, there's an account of a god who survives death that predates Christianity. But it's not anything like the resurrection account. Another goddess collects the pieces of this god that was cut up or whatever and puts him back together. And part of the time he has a ghost-like existence on earth, and the other time he's in the nether world. Also, there's no evidence whatsoever that Egyptian beliefs from centuries earlier had any influence on Palestine at all. This is just grasping at straws. If anything, after the exile in Babylon, the Jews, with all their faults, kept to the one God. They weren't tempted to follow the gods of Philistia or Egypt or whatever. Okay. Another thing that's brought up is hallucinations. That these apostles were devastated. They had given up 3 years of their lives to follow Jesus. They thought for sure he was the Messiah. He did all this amazing stuff. And then in a matter of days, it's all gone. He's arrested, he's killed. And so in their grief, in their desire to have the Lord with them again, one of them or all of them hallucinated Christ being there. When we know people can hallucinate, right? And the chances of hallucinating are greater if you're under severe stress, you haven't been sleeping, and that kind of thing. A problem with that is hallucinations are private. There's no examples of mass group hallucinations. It doesn't account for the empty tomb. It doesn't account for Paul and what he experienced and his meeting with the others. And, of course, if we believe what Paul said he got from Peter and James was that Jesus appeared to Peter, the 12, we know he appeared to the women, and 500 people at one time. And hallucinations can't really explain that. Now, Bart Ehrman, who I've talked about earlier, he explains it this way. Peter had a hallucination. He knows you can't say everybody had a hallucination. So Peter had a hallucination. There was this kerfuffle about an empty tomb, and Peter told the other apostles, they believed what Peter said and were off to the races. And the story of 500 people at once probably never happened. It was the apostles exaggerating the stuff to bolster their position and so on. Well, you can take that position, but it really doesn't fit the evidence that we have. Also, it's unlikely that these apostles would have gone to their deaths based on Peter saying that he saw Jesus. It just doesn't fit. Another critique is delusions, that maybe they were deluded, like Jim Jones and his, what was the name of his group, the People's Temple or whatever it was called, people committing mass suicide and so on. You do get people deluded following something, but something that they know is a lie. It certainly doesn't explain Paul. Paul was not somebody anxious to be with Jesus again, full of grief. On the contrary, he wanted to wipe Jesus and his followers out. He wasn't anxious to meet Jesus. He had to be knocked down and blinded and so on. We're going to talk more about Paul next time. Another is that, well, the apostles really wanted power and influence. That's why they made all this up. I think you can realize that was highly unlikely that they thought this would lead to fame and fortune by saying that they had seen this. Another is visions. It's kind of like hallucinations. And because they use Paul as the example of a vision and not a physical resurrection, we're going to save that for next week. N.T. Wright comes back to these questions. In order to explain the resurrection stories and what the disciples were willing to endure afterwards, he says you have to have a solution that says, that answers the questions, why did Christianity begin and begin with a whole new view of Messiah and resurrection? Why were the disciples willing to die for their faith in the risen Jesus? And what provided the explosive power for this faith to spread quickly despite persecution throughout the Roman Empire? Of course, we as believers say the simple answer is looking you right in the face. Jesus rose from the dead. And as Luke puts it in Acts 1:3, he presented himself alive to them after his suffering by many proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. Okay, we have a few minutes if there's any questions or comments. Yeah, James. Yes.
You have the example of the Appian Way, where all of these rebels
yes.
were crucified and left to rot.
Right.
To all other people traveling down that road. Wouldn't it be safe to assume that someone like Jesus, who would have been at least not labeled as a political dissident, would have
yes. So James makes the point, why the Romans probably would have left these people on the cross. We have stories of rows of dead bodies or crosses with dead bodies for miles. Why wouldn't they have done the same thing with Jesus? It's true that in many cases, the Romans left them on the cross to be picked apart by birds and so forth. Historians think that it's very likely, however, that, remember, the crucifixion happened in Jerusalem, the heart of the Jewish nation. And it happened at the time of the Passover when you had, what is it, three times the normal population, right? And the Jews had very specific religious problems with dead bodies being exposed and so forth. So it's very reasonable to assume that if a Jewish family member or a Jewish official came and said, hey, can we take this body or these bodies down? We're about to celebrate our Passover and so forth. That's not an unreasonable thing to consider. And as we mentioned earlier, Roman law said that Roman officials could release the body of an executed criminal to a family or a friend if they wanted to. Any other questions? Okay, well, Lord willing, we'll pick up with Paul next week.